Medical errors. How big of a problem are they, and what can be done? Last week, a report published in the BMJ, formerly known as the British Medical Journal, made big headlines across the country. By analyzing other studies, it found that medical errors are more common than most people believe, and are, in fact, the third leading cause of death in the U.S., behind heart disease and cancer. There's been some pushback to the methods and assumptions in the BMJ report, but even those critical of it agree that medical errors are too common in hospitals and other healthcare facilities. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with healthcare leaders in Maine about the issue. How do doctors and hospitals determine when a mistake has been made? What's being done to improve? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A major report came out in 1999 titled, "To Err is Human." It pointed out how prevalent mistakes are in healthcare, from surgical slip-ups to mistaken patient identities. But it also said that the problem had less to do with bad doctors than it did to do with a medical system in need of change. That report came out 17 years ago, and according to a new study, too little has changed. The new study states that medical error is the third leading cause of death in the U.S. How bad is the problem in Maine? And what's being done? With me in our studio, Stephen Michaud. He is president of the Maine Hospital Association. Dr. Dora Ann Mills, University of New England's vice president for clinical affairs and director of the Center for Excellence in Health Innovation. And Lisa Letourneau, who is executive director of Maine Quality Counts. Thank you all for joining us today. And I should note that this is our first regular Friday broadcast in our new schedule. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have concerns about patient safety? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet, if you do that, at Maine Calling. And you can post on the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Letourneau, I'm going to start with you. What is a medical error? I know in some cases it's clear a sponge is left in someone's body during surgery, but it's really a difficult thing to define sometimes, isn't it?
Well, Jennifer, thank you for inviting me onto the show. And I think I would agree it can be difficult. But luckily, I happen to have an official definition of medical error that, if you don't mind,
you carry
I'd love
with
to,
you, right?
I do. Well, actually, it comes from the British Medical Journal BMJ article that has been the cause for a lot of interest that cited this third leading cause of death in the U.S., that headline. So they themselves pull from previous definitions. So I'm going to read it. It's a little bit long, and then I'll offer my thoughts. But medical error has been defined as an unintended act, either of omission or commission, which I think is an important distinction to make. So either something that's done or not done, or one that does not achieve its intended outcome, the failure of a planned action to be completed as intended, the use of a wrong plan to achieve an aim, or a deviation from the process of care that may or may not cause harm to the patient. So the short version, I think, of that.
That's the short version.
That is, no. My short version is, I think one could summarize it as something that an individual or maybe a care team does or does not do that may or may not result in harm. So it is a distinction between, you know, an intended act that does not follow through because something breaks down, usually unintentionally, a system failure, a human errors problem, we just simply forget, we're tired, whatever it is, that sometimes results in medical error may result in harm, and sometimes it doesn't. So there's a lot there, I think, that needs to be considered in this conversation.
How about if somebody dies when doctors are trying to figure out what's wrong with them? So not necessarily a misdiagnosis, but we don't have the proper diagnosis yet. Is that considered a medical error?
Not necessarily, and I think that's a really important point, right? So sometimes medical errors do or do not cause harm, and sometimes bad outcomes occur, and there may or may not be an error. So maybe every single thing went right along the way, and the patient had a very virulent bacteria that caused death, and everything was being done right, but it just happened. So I think that's important to recognize
All
as
right.
well.
Dora Mills, how big of a problem is this? I know that this article said third, if it were a disease, it would be categorized by the CDC as the third leading cause of death in the U.S. I also know there's been some pushback to the methodology in this article. Do you believe that's about right? Do you believe the article's got it right?
I do. And I'll be honest with you, when the first big study came out, the Institute of Medicine report that you mentioned a few minutes ago in 1999, To Air is Human, and they estimated between 44,000 and 98,000 people dying every year in hospitals due to medical errors in the United States. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, like a lot of healthcare professionals, I actually looked at the data and I didn't believe it. And I looked through that study, and they had taken three studies from three different states, small sample sizes, and had extrapolated them nationally.
So at the time, you thought that number was too high.
I thought that was too high. And I'll say my watershed moment was a couple of years later when a patient advocate said to me, "What are you doing?" I was at the state at the time directing the public health agency. And she said, "What are you doing about medical errors?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know if that data, it's extrapolated from just three studies with small sample sizes, da, 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 da." And she said, "So you don't believe the 98,000, that top end, do you believe it's something lower?" And I said, "Well, you know, I guess it could be the 44,000, which was the lower end of the estimate." And suddenly I realized that what I was saying, which was 44,000, maybe that's acceptable. And I wasn't meaning to say that, but I realized, oh my goodness, that's a huge number. And the reason why it also struck me that day was because the day before, I had spent in the legislature testifying on a bill to change Maine's seatbelt law from a secondary to primary seatbelt law, meaning you could get stopped just for not wearing a seatbelt. And one of the reasons I gave was why it was so important was that about 40 to 45,000 people died from car crashes every year in the United States. And that number was so high, and so many of them were due to people not wearing their seatbelts. And I thought, you know, if I could spend that kind of time going to the legislature and supporting this bill because of 40 to 45,000 deaths due to car crashes, of course I should be spending effort on medical errors when even the low estimate at the time was 44,000. Subsequent studies have shown the number to be much larger. And in fact, this particular British Medical Journal article isn't a new analysis per se. It's not a new study. It's an analysis of prior studies that have been done. And so what they've done is taken data from other studies and done a point estimate of about 250,000. A study from a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, showed estimates of 210 to 440,000 deaths. Wow. Study before that from Medicare, from the Government Accounting Office in Congress showed that the estimate to be about 180,000 just Medicare, people with Medicare insurance dying in hospitals. And of course, all of these studies have been done on hospital data, not even knowing how many die in long-term care facilities, outpatient settings due to medical errors. So clearly, and I have gone through the data since then, these newer studies, and I think they are very believable, and it shows we have a major public health problem on our hands. And I've been saying for several years that if you were to match it up with the leading causes of death, it would be the third leading cause of death. The good news is there's also a lot going on in Maine, too, to address that. But
well,
it is
let's
a huge
talk,
issue.
Yeah, let's talk about that with Stephen Michaud. I know that this is probably a huge part of the conversation with your member hospitals. How seriously are hospitals in Maine taking this information, and what are they doing?
Yeah, I actually feel better already because I thought I was the only one that didn't believe the 1999 report until a certain time. And my event was when I talked to my own people, and I said to them, "That can't be right in 1999." And they said, "Yeah, it probably is, and then some." And that's when I realized, oh, wow, we have a serious problem. And, you know, I could pick apart this study. I think there are some problems with it. It's not the point. Same thing that Dora said. You know, we look at it and we go, well, when you look at their death rate, you go, that means over 99% of the people are getting appropriate care, if you will. They're not dying. Really? No matter how you skin it, it's tens of thousands of people. And that is the, I think, one of the great calls to action of our time in this field. We have a cost problem. We have a lot of problems. But I don't think there's anything of more urgency than this one. Our folks, listen, ever since 1999, it's been all hands on deck on this issue. It's amazing. Prior to that, we didn't talk about these things very much. And then after that, it seems like that's all we're doing. So there's a tremendous amount going on to address it. Systems have changed. Untold education. I mean, that's our main mission in this area is continually educating our folks about the new ways of doing things to eliminate harm. I think when this study came out, it was pretty sobering because we looked at that and we said, okay, we've been at this for 15 years. And let me give you a concrete example. You go in, and I've had a couple of minor procedures myself, and you see some of the fruit of it. They ask you who you are multiple times, your birth date multiple times, to the point where you think, why are they doing this? They ask, the doctor literally asks you, which leg are we operating on today? Multiple people do. They mark it with a marker. You know, and I love that because I see the fruits of all of those things that we're doing. So, and for you, the listeners, that's to avoid a wrong site surgery. So you don't operate in the wrong knee. So there's been wonderful things that have happened, but you just look at this and you go, we've got a long way to go. And it's multifaceted. You know, we've again, our biggest priority is sharing best practices, okay? If something bad has occurred, first of all, get that information out and talk about it amongst the hospitals or whoever it may affect. And then who has figured out a good way of doing something? Make sure everybody knows that. That's hugely important, and we believe has saved a lot of lives and a lot of care. But there are very systemic, clearly, there are systemic problems, and that's the part of the show where what do we do now that we need to talk about.
Right. Lisa, why is this so hard?
Oh, boy.
We have an hour.
Maybe about 5 hours.
It's complicated, right? It's good. If it were easy, we would have figured it out already. I think at its core, it has to do with being human, right? And I think that we have had a very unrealistic expectation of perfection from we mere mortals in healthcare, interestingly. Yet in other industries, if you think of the airline industry, one is one, right, that is often brought in as an example, where the airline industry several decades ago now said being mere mortals is not enough, that even one plane crash is too many. And they really took seriously the notion of human factors engineering. We shouldn't rely on pilots to know everything. Therefore, we have checklists before planes take off, right? We shouldn't rely on one person to fly a plane. Therefore, there are co-pilots and people who back up. We shouldn't rely on the notion that the pilot always makes the right decision. Therefore, they tried to flatten the power hierarchy and said everybody has the ability to speak up and the responsibility to speak up. Some of those ideas have translated to healthcare. There's actually a project that Dora and I have both been involved in called Team Steps, which takes training directly from the U.S. military and applies it to healthcare, but not enough of it yet, I think. And I think still in medicine, either the systems aren't quite there or the acceptance that we need team approaches or we need to use that same science of human factors engineering to anticipate and help prevent errors in a way that is just recognizing the limitations of our own humanity.
Is part of the problem a fear of lawsuits that hospitals are afraid if we talk about this error in which somebody died, we'll get sued? You're not so certain that that's been part of the issue.
I think that may be part of it, but honestly, this notion of going backwards to build in this human systems engineering that's not really, if anything, fear of lawsuit should prompt more work on that. So I do think, fear of liability may limit people's willingness to talk about things, but the notions that I'm talking about even go before an error happens.
And I think we also have to keep in mind, this is Dora, but that medicine in general has become much more complicated. I mean, Lisa and Steve and I are old enough to remember the days when people sat in hospitals recovering. You know, they just sat there to get fed and to start learning how to walk around. You don't sit in a hospital just recovering. You now go home to do that. And if you think about the medications that are prescribed, over 90% of them didn't even exist 30 years ago. So medicine has become much more complex, which is called, I think, for this need that Lisa talks about, with really a systems approach where you're trying to take away, you're trying to implement systems that take away the human error a bit. And so, I mean, just as one brief example that people might understand, 20, 30 years ago when we were practicing, you know, you wrote an order on a piece of paper for medication. And then it went to the pharmacy and the hospital, say, and it got filled and it got given to the patient. So, and the pharmacist might check on things, make sure it was the right dose. But the weight of the patient wasn't necessarily on the order. So as a pediatrician, for instance, that's really important. And nowadays, there are these systems where you put the order into a computer, and it automatically checks if that dose is the right amount for that patient, given their weight and age and whatever, and if they're on any other medications that may interact. So that's an example, these systems that help reduce the number of errors that happen just from ordering medications. They're not perfect, but I mean, they're helping to reduce the errors, which are important these days given how many more medications there are available that people are on.
Sure, and to add to that, Stephen, in most main hospitals, that medication has a barcode on it, and the nurse is checking that barcode of that medication against the barcode on the patient's wrist, which makes me wonder if, you know, we've had main calling programs, we've talked about this a lot, when is the electronic health record system in Maine going to be, you know, fully functional and everybody on board? Do you believe, Stephen, that when we are able to have an effective electronic health record system, that many medical errors will be diminished? Or do you believe that'll just be another layer of potential problems?
I'll be a contrarian about this. Okay. I think it's more the latter is what I fear. Now, one can't imagine going back to paper, can we? We would never do that. But there's a lot of discussion among physicians and others right now of the complexity. Dora just hit it. I just this past week asked one of my CEOs, who's also a nurse, who's passionate about these things, and I said, what are we going to do about, you know, this study? And the first thing out of her mouth was complexity. It is just getting so complex. Listen, if you ask a physician if we've made his or her life more simple by adding electronic medical records and computer physician entry for drugs, they're gonna tell you how we've made it much more complicated is what you're going to hear. So we've got to go down that road. We're hoping that the statewide integration will help. And I don't think there's any doubt. Dora just gave a great example. I don't think there's any doubt that it can help. I fear the complexity of what we are laying on our caregivers, not just doctors, but nurses at the bedside. I fear that greatly. And that just calls for these kinds of system assessments and changes that we're going to need to do. So it's part of the mix, but I fear complexity because I think that's what's fueling a lot of this right now.
So we do have to go to a break. When we get back, I want to talk to you from a patient's perspective. If you are to be a patient, if someone you love is to be a patient, what would you recommend that person do going into a hospital? But we need to take a break. We'll also get to your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And the Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering quality care for your heart from the heart, close to home. Learn more at cmhvi.org. And DR Struck Landscape Nursery, celebrating its 30th anniversary on the 30th of each month this year. Open daily on Route 202 in Winthrop.
Hi, this is Guy Raz from the TED Radio Hour. Imagine the possibilities if Maine Public Radio now has 48 hours a day with the addition of its new Maine Public Classical channel. We thought that might mean TED can find a better time to be heard, and that is indeed the case, and not once, but twice. TED is now on Saturday afternoons at 2 and Wednesday evenings at 11. Hope you can join us.
To see the new program schedules for both Maine Public Radio and the new Maine Public Classical Channel, visit mpbn.net.
In a crime police station in occupied France, a group of men wonder why they've been arrested.
I am walking down the street before a car pulls up beside me. A man gets out and measures my nose. They measure my nose.
Ari Gross and Gregory Itzen star in Arthur Miller's Incident at Vichy, next time on L.A. Theatre Works.
Join us for L.A. Theatre Works coming up this Sunday evening at 9 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Avoiding Medical Errors. With me in our studio, Dora Ann Mills, the University of New England's Vice President for Clinical Affairs, former head of the Maine CDC. Lisa Letourneau is Executive Director at Maine Quality Counts. And Stephen Michaud is President of the Maine Hospital Association. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we turn to the calls, I wanted to put out to you, if you're know that you're going to have a procedure and you will be in the hospital, or you suspect you might, or you know someone, what advice do you give? I know someone who goes in with a spiral notebook, mm-hmm. and everything that is said to her, she writes it down. You know, that's fine if you're lucid and conscious and not over, you know, not sleepy from medications. You're nodding, Dora. Do you recommend that people do that?
Absolutely. I recommend four things. One is take a notebook with you and write everything down that people are telling you. And second of all, bring a friend, a family member, particularly because, as we mentioned earlier, I mean, people who are hospitalized now are tend to be much sicker. So that family, a friend, it would be good for you to stay with you, particularly on the hours when they're doing rounds, or they don't have to be there 24 hours a day, but spend, you know, have a schedule set up so that you have a friend or family member with you several hours a day, preferably the beginning of the day, maybe midday, and then at the end of the day. I mean, that sounds kind of funny, but I mean, just it could be an hour or two each part of the time, and have them take notes in that notebook. The third thing is to verify all medications that are given to you. Make sure that friend or family member does it, writes it down. You should have in that notebook all the list of medications that you're on. You can look them up, Google them, and find out what's, you know, what the side effects are and the like, because you may be suffering some side effects from the medications rather than your illness in some cases. Make sure that anytime somebody comes in to give you a medication that you verify it in the notebook. And then the fourth thing is to be the hand-washing patrol. Make sure and have the friends or family member also be there to do that. When you see somebody come in, if they haven't washed their hands, ask them to. And you can, I know that's kind of awkward to do, so you can either blame it on your son-in-law or some relative, or blame it on me. Just say, you know, I heard Dr. Mills on public radio recently, and she asked everybody to make sure to check when anybody comes, even if they're going to touch your IV pole, you know, the intravenous pole, no matter what, or your bed. They need, even if they have gloves on, they need to be changing their gloves or washing their hands. And before they touch you, your bed, your IV pole, or whatever, no excuses. And you can blame it on me or blame it on a favorite in-law or something.
Yeah, Stephen.
It's tricky, though. You know, I've tried to do this when either one of my parents is in the hospital, to be there when the doctors come around on rounds. You don't know exactly when they're coming around. And, you know, you can try to be there from 7 to 9 in the morning, and you'll still sometimes miss them. So it's great advice, but it's not always easy to get this right.
That's right.
I'll jump in to say it. Then in that case, I think it's okay to ask them to call you. And I think people are sometimes afraid, am I going to bother the doctor? Yes, it may take more time, but it's your right as a patient and a family member to have that information and understand what's going on. If you know you can't be there or you're afraid you're going to miss it, a note at the bedside, a note with the nurse, please call daughter, you know, at this number. The other thing I was just going to add on to Dora's very good advice for the four steps is to be particularly aware of high-risk conditions. And in some of the literature that's come out recently, those are very clear. Medication errors, so Dora talked about that. Infections, Dora talked about that in terms of hand washing, but also a high level of sensitivity could an infection be happening. Blood clots in the legs, particularly after surgeries that involve people being inactive for some period of time, and particularly if you have another condition like cancer or belly surgery. Pressure ulcers, particularly for people, again, who are in the same position in bed for a while. fall, particularly for people who are older or confused, and then surgical complications, with any surgery being aware of that. So I think people going into hospitals should be particularly attentive to what's happening in those kind, with those kinds of situations.
So I know there are lots of risks with what I know is known as Dr. Google, but it really isn't a bad idea to go to a credible medical website and do some research about
Absolutely.
Your procedure risks and inform yourself before you go into the hospital.
Ask questions. It's okay. You know, I have my mother's 86, and I'll tell her this, and she'll say, "Is that okay to ask? Are they going to get mad at me?" Yes, it's okay to ask. You should ask.
Yes.
What is my complication? What is my risk of complications of a blood clot, of pressure ulcer, of an infection with this procedure? What should I do to help minimize that risk?
And I should just mention on top of that that one of the most common sources of medical errors is actually hospital-acquired infections. And they often come from places that you wouldn't suspect. So for instance, not washing hands, but also catheters that are left in urinary catheters that are left in after surgery often are left too long. And that results in a urinary tract infection, which if you're sick and then get into your blood, particularly, and cause you to be very ill or even
die. So you
die.
Can ask, is my catheter still in yet?
Right. And anything
when's it coming out?
anything that's in your body, you know, whether it's a catheter, a urinary catheter or an IV or whatever, ask and or have your family ask, when can that come out? Because the longer things are inside of you, the longer they are to cause, the more risk there are to cause an infection.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones. We're going to start with Jim, who's calling from Harpswell. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes. You can hear me now.
Yes.
My comment relates to several things you've mentioned, both the additional medical record keeping and also the problem of maybe having items too long in your body. A relative of mine is a nurse in one of the major hospitals and has often mentioned how apparently at certain times understaffed they appear to be, and that they often spend time doing the reporting when they would like to have been doing more attendance to the patients. So I'm wondering if any of you think that staffing itself could be a problem, and obviously it will cost more to staff up, and nobody wants to increase the cost of medical care, so it seems like the tension of keeping costs down may be leading to this problem.
Stephen Michaud.
The caller is absolutely right. It is the tension is what concerns me about the future. So we have two major pressures on us right now, very appropriately. Reduce cost, because we all know it's unaffordable, and to stop what we are talking about here from happening. And they are in conflict. Now, they're not in perfect conflict, but they are in conflict. 60% of the hospital's cost is labor. You push too much on cost, it inevitably affects labor. So we also know that there is a correlation between staffing levels and patient safety. We know that. It's intuitive, plus we know it through research. So that is part of it and an important part of it. So it's one thing that we're constantly concerned about. Listen, we've got to reduce cost, but we're about saving lives and making people well. We can't go so far that it impacts what we do in a core way. So one of the keys to that is we still believe, and I think my colleagues here will agree with me, that there's a lot of what I'll term waste in the system. And I don't mean waste, fraud, and abuse. I mean care that we don't think is necessary to deliver in a lot of cases, meaning let's get people in the right place at the right time for the care they need. We think there's savings there. That's the kind of reform we need. But we fear the sledgehammer effect of containing costs and what that means for exactly what the caller was just referring to.
Do you advocate for having mandates about hospital staffing? I know this is one of the more controversial issues out there, but you know, if a hospital is facing these pressures and saying we need to cut costs and maybe we can do it staff, do you advocate there being or support there being a law that say you can't go below this level? Would that make it easier for administrators to know
No, it's actually a nightmare administratively for us. You know, unless it translated into, oh, well, then all of a sudden the Medicaid program will pay their costs or Medicare will pay their costs, which is a fantasy. So what it does is it says that the legislature would decide what the staffing level is on a medical surgical unit in at Maine Medical Center or at Midcoast Hospital. It's ludicrous. That's got to because of the way patient flow is, patient acuity. You may have more sick people here, less sick people there. You got to leave it to the managers to make those kinds of staffing decisions, in our view.
And I would just add to that, too, something that actually Lisa alluded to a few minutes ago, which is that it's not just about the numbers of staffing. It's also about how the staff who exist work together. And, you know, if you had a baseball team and you trained the second baseman separately from the outfielders, separately from the designated hitters, et cetera, et cetera. And then on opening day, you said, okay, team, get together and play as a team. They would not know how to play together. And yet that's exactly what's happened in healthcare education forever. Lisa and I are both physicians. We went through 7 years or so of medical school, internship and residency training. Never once were we sat intentionally or put intentionally with a nursing student and or with physical therapist or respiratory therapist or whomever. And so, yeah, we were put then outside of our training. We were said, OK, here, go ahead and, you know, and start practicing medicine. You're qualified now. But we didn't we were never taught intentionally what are the roles and responsibilities of nurses versus doctors versus whomever else. And so one of the things we're doing at University of New England, and we're on the forefront of this nationally, is we have 15 health profession degree programs, medicine, pharmacy, dental medicine, nursing, and many others. And we're actually educating them together, not all day long, but they have parts of their education where they learn about each other's professions, learn how to communicate together. And then we're putting them into clinical sites across Maine, rural Maine and urban Maine, together in teams, pharmacy, medical, nursing students, like together. And that's actually it's been a catalyst for change within the clinical sites themselves because we're all learning about each other from within about each other. And what we're realizing when you look at the medical errors and you do a root cause analysis, 80% of those medical error deaths are due to poor teamwork, poor communication, poor collaboration, poor coordination. And so one of the experts in patient safety will all tell you that particularly because of the complexity of healthcare that's gotten much more complicated over the last 30 years, we as healthcare providers need to learn together how to work together as a better team. Team STEPS training is something Lisa and I have been involved in, the Maine Hospital Association as well, but also starting at the beginning of health professions education. We know health professionals want to do, they go in to the profession because they want to help. And yet we don't even know about each other and how to talk each other's languages.
Jim, thank you so much for your call. We have an email from Dave. He writes, I'm wondering if these numbers include the, quote, adverse reactions to prescription medications that also kill tens of thousands of people a year. So going back to the study that precipitated this program today, calling medical error the third leading cause of death, does that include, Lisa, adverse reactions in their methodology?
I believe that it does. Again, the study isn't a new study. It's a review
right.
of several existing studies, so each had their own definition, but I believe most of them certainly would have.
Okay. In hospital settings.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Right.
We're going to go to a David who's calling from Bangor. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you so much. It sounds very informative, and I'm a physician in the area, one of the few remaining private physicians, but I frequent the hospital a lot, and the few Keystone hospitals certainly been able to provide a lot of services to Maine that otherwise wouldn't be available. But my question has to do with, a couple of things. One is the centralization of medicine and how that affects a patient's potential complication, where you take healthy individuals that may be coming in for something elective, hand surgery or a knee replacement or something. And because of the centralization of our medical system now, they're having to have their surgeries done under the same roof in general with the sickest of the sick, who really are the ones that benefit the most from the wonderful hospital system that we have in place, which kind of And so my question is, you know, is it the best thing for the public for these, you know, hernias and other sorts of what we call a surgeon's clean cases? Should those be done, you know, in a big centralized area where there's certainly worse bugs at large? And the second part of my question is, because of the difference in the way the billing tends to be run for a hospital versus in a private setting, where you have a difference between a bill for the same services, including anesthesia and facility, to be, say, $60,000 at a hospital versus, say, $17,000 at an outpatient surgery center where the infection rate tends to be a little lower. I guess I'm wondering if maybe we could coach our consumers or patients out there to maybe be a little bit more knowledgeable about where they're going and what sorts of charges they'll end up looking for. And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting question, David. Stay there just a second if you haven't hung up already, because and you're talking about some surgeries. You used a hernia as an example of, you know, being a sort of a less complicated surgery for somebody who's not as sick. But then you're also talking about there are a lot of outpatient centers. If somebody has cataract surgery or something like that, there are more of these specialty clinics around for specialty surgeries. So do you believe that there should be more of these and fewer procedures done in hospitals in general?
I think it makes the most amount of sense to take the professions or the specialties that deal mostly with what we call clean cases, where the infection rate should be close to zero. And I think those should be done in a particular setting, preferably away from an ICU where there's antibiotics running 24/7. And I think that, you know, surgeries where there are clean contaminated cases, like colon cases and those sorts of things, but they're still being done on the healthy people, I think that those people would benefit by having their surgeries done someplace where there aren't lots of ICU.
Okay, you know, I just glanced at the clock. I realize we have to go to a break. So, Stephen Michaud, I'm going to have you address David's question after our break. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lee Nissan in Auburn and Topsom, with Level 3 charging stations available for all electric vehicle owners. Learn more at leeauto.com. And Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces. Condo Furniture.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Siddhartha Mukherjee. He was the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, and his new book on the gene is every bit as fascinating and important.
The divisive debates that are seemingly cultural debates are really debates about human beings and identity. And if they are debates about human beings and identity, then they have to be debates about genes.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour coming up tomorrow at 3 in the afternoon and Sunday at 11. And coming up in just about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, the Diane Rehm Show International Week in Review. That's Hour 2 of the Diane Rehm Show. This is in addition to the National Week in Review. We broadcast at 10 a.m. in our new schedule here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Reducing Medical Errors. With me in our studio, the president of the Maine Hospital Association, Stephen Michaud, the executive director of Maine Quality Counts, Lisa Letourneau, and the director for the Center of Excellence in Health Innovation at the University of New England, Dora Ann Mills. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-399. 3566. Before the break, we were not able to answer the question by the independent doctor, Stephen. And so I would like to, Stephen Michaud, let you have a chance to answer his question, which I believe is, by bringing people who are very sick in the same place with people who are having what he refers to as clean surgeries, are we increasing the odds for error?
Yeah, probably not. I think he's making a leap that I'm not ready to, and that is that, you know, a simple procedure is being done next to an ICU, and I think it's not understanding exactly how surgical suites are made, how they are organized. Outpatient surgeries are where outpatient surgeries occur. Inpatient surgeries tend to be in different places. So I think there's more segmentation there than he probably is either understanding or realizes. And again, in our view, the same infection controls ought to be taking place, and they are. I mean, but they need to be taking place in the same place, same setting, no matter where. The other thing is the assumption that it is – I think there's, by the way, very good care with outside of the hospital being conducted as well. But we don't necessarily know that as much. The hospitals are under a whole lot of scrutiny, not necessarily outside the four walls. So, again, he's making a leap I'm probably not ready to do.
Okay. And also he wanted to know about patients doing their own homework. And Dora, you said there are places that people can go to do some research, and we can
Absolutely.
Put those on our website.
Yes. And, in fact, you know, I think so many people are used to spending more time trying to figure out where they're going to buy a car from and what kind of car they're going to buy than they do where they're going to get their health care. And as Steve mentioned, there are more places now where you can get information from, though not on a lot. There are not a lot of places you can get information on ambulatory surgical care centers, for instance, or small hospitals. But there are a couple of great resources. One is hospital safety. If you're looking at patient safety issues, hospitalsafetyscore.org, which is run by the LeapFrog organization out of the LeapFrog group out of Washington, D.C., which is headed up by Leah Binder from Maine. So they have a really very complex and one of the oldest systems in the country for rating hospitals. And the good news is Maine hospitals do very well. I think the best in the country
in
terms of
the
LeapFrog safety score. So the hospitalsafetyscore.org, and then also the federal government, Medicare.gov, has a hospital compare website. So if you just Google Medicare.gov hospital compare, you'll get their website. And Quality Counts is also a wonderful website on information. So since their CEO's here, Lisa, explain there, because they've got a great source of information too.
Well, thanks, Dora. And what we've our focus has really been more about trying to help patients and families become engaged participants in their care. So on our website, we've got information on the program called Choosing Wisely, which helps people understand what questions to ask and information about making decisions about healthcare tests and services. The other one I would throw out in Maine is getbettermaine.org, which is from the Maine Health Management Coalition that pulls in much of this information from sites like LeapFrog and Medicare into one place where people
and
can
I
look.
Will put those all on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page as soon as the program is over. Frank writes on email, why is it not required by all Maine hospitals for surgeons to use checklists in the operating rooms? Why not a state law requiring them? Even Atul Gawande in his book Checklists acknowledges that his operating room has caught human errors using checklists.
Yeah, I'm not sure we need a law, but I think that is what is happening actually in our hospitals is absolutely going to checklists. By the way, they're not the end all and be all, and I think Lisa made a good point right from the get-go. This is a systems issue, but we are dealing with human beings as well that make errors. So we want checklists to help check on the human error. But what we have found, and I think research has shown, it's not the end all and be all, but it's happening. I mean, I'm not sure we need to pass a law, but it is absolutely happening. Points taken.
And I'll just jump in to say that's a great question to ask your surgeon, isn't it? So
absolutely.
If somebody is about to go into surgery, that's perfectly okay. And I think people, again, a little resist. It's okay to ask my doctor that? It's okay to ask. Ask your doctor, hey, do you guys use a checklist in your surgical suite? And if so, you know, how yes or no, how do you make sure that I'm going to stay safe?
And I just wanted to add one quick thing on that. When both doctors gave incredibly good advice about what patients should do, there is that hesitancy. If I could just add one thing, it's that hospitals and their staffs are getting used to this. It's not like it used to be.
It's not like you're going to be the first person to ask this question.
That is exactly right. More and more people need to do it, but don't be afraid of it. First of all, as Lisa said, it's your right. It's your responsibility to do it. But they're used to this. They're getting more and more used to these. So feel free is what I would say.
And I should say also, not a checklist by itself. There's some studies that actually show that it doesn't do that much. But it's the checklist with the team training where we all are learning better how to work together as a team that makes a big difference in terms of whether those checklists work. Another, also just because it came to mind, there are a number of hospitals now that are using open notes, which means that you have access to your medical record, which you can ask for while you're hospitalized. I've been in hospitals where in the lobby there is a sign promoting patients to ask to look at their medical records. And there are actually some very good studies that show when patients in the hospital and or their family members are looking at the medical records, because they're electronic these days, and looking at the notes, they catch errors. They catch things. And it actually empowers the patient to be part of that team. You know, this isn't a baseball team with the patient left out. We are really evolving to a team approach that includes the patient, including I've been at hospitals where the patients are actually included in the rounds in the morning, patients and the family members.
What an idea.
So we're really evolving a culture where it's much more of a team sport, so to speak. Not really a sport, obviously, but a team event. Yep. And patients are part of that team. But we as healthcare providers have to get more used to that. And as they are, as Steve mentioned, but also patients as well have to get used to that.
Okay, boy, we have lots of calls and emails. In just a little bit of time, I'm going to go to Evelyn calling from Mercer. Hi, Evelyn, go ahead.
Hi. I just have a comment to make, and it may go back to what was being spoken about in the beginning of the program about electronic records and so forth. I just feel that when you go to your doctor, primary care, or any doctor, they seem to have to spend more time looking at the computer than they do looking at the patient. And sometimes, you know, they have time constraints as far as how long the appointment is. And, you know, I do go in with a list, so I kind of shoot off all my questions. But I do find that that's a little disconcerting sometimes.
Agree.
It's probably, as I often say, it is probably the number one complaint I'm hearing now from average people.
Yes.
Is that very thing. I see my doctor briefly, and the whole time he or she is on their computer. It's a big challenge. I agree with you. Again, it's hard to imagine going back to paper, but we've got to deal with that. That's a big issue.
Lisa.
Yeah, and I think it is a really important issue to bring up, and I think there are better ways to do it. So in our organization, we do a lot of work with primary care practices and try to bring in, just as we were saying earlier, best practices, examples from around the country. I think it is very understandable that it happens that way now, and there are better ways to do it. There are lots of good examples from clinicians and practices around the country where they figured out how to make, again, the patient part of the team, looking at the computer together, you know, having a screen that faces the patient. Other practices where they are fortunate have figured out ways to hire scribes, people who literally sit in the visit with you and scribe in the electronic health record while the clinician has face-to-face time. So I would encourage patients to talk to their practice about it. It doesn't have to be a bad experience. And letting a clinician or a practice know that it didn't feel comfortable, that it didn't feel like a relationship, and encourage them to try to learn ways to do it better.
Evelyn, thanks so much for your call. Peter sent an email, which I am going to edit on the fly here, but he wants to talk about how data analysis is way underutilized. He says, doctors think treatment is an art, but I would argue that if the end value is large enough, trends do arise. Think the Dartmouth Atlas. Does that mean anything to you all?
We all know the Dartmouth Atlas. That's an excellent point. I mean, healthcare is just now really coming into the 21st century, I think, in terms of the data. You know, because of the records used to be by paper, and because electronic records weren't able to communicate with each other and so many things weren't getting reported, the big data are just starting to come to healthcare, so that we're realizing we're realizing much more quickly than we used to what treatments are working and what treatments aren't, and also individualizing treatments. So what may work for somebody may not work. The same treatment may need to be really individualized for somebody else. The Dartmouth Atlas, you can actually get it online or get at least what it is online. But it's about the variability in how healthcare is being delivered.
Right.
So it's an atlas of health outcomes and health procedures, and how there's great variability, for instance, of C-section rates by community,
right,
when there shouldn't be.
And Lisa, this issue of data goes back to the very beginning of this conversation, doesn't it? When we're talking about how many medical errors are there, what is a medical error, how do we even quantify what a medical error is? One of the issues is that these are not kept track of in this way.
It's tough. It is very difficult. You know, so I am all for tracking data, all for learning from the data. One of the challenges, though, is defining exactly when a medical error has occurred. Because of that, I think there's been more of a focus on adverse events, particularly those that tend to have a high association with errors, such as, again, infections, falls, medication, adverse reactions. So, yes, and it is a very difficult thing to do.
Okay. And we have another email here. This is Frank. And again, I can't read the whole email, but he's writing as a practicing internist. He wants to caution against comparing the practice of medicine to the airline industry and talks about a lot of the variables. Unfortunately, we don't have much time, but just saying the complexity of medical practice is orders of magnitude more complex than flying airplanes.
Sure. I mean, I think we all agree with that. But I think there are still lessons from the military, from the airline industry, from other industries, and including the teamness. I keep talking about it, but it is, again, when you do a root cause analysis, 80% of these medical error deaths are due to poor teamwork. And the military and the airline industry has figured out how to improve teamwork. And that's one of the big lessons I think we in healthcare have to learn.
Stephen, if we're having this conversation in another decade, will numbers be better? Are you optimistic?
Oh, boy, I hope so. Two different times we've had somebody from the airline safety industry, if you will, present to our people. We believe that. I also think the doctor's right. It's not perfectly symmetrical. And no, I don't think anybody's saying that. You know, if the airline industry has done a lot to, obviously, they do a fantastic job, but they also don't fly in bad weather. They don't fly when the environment isn't correct, right? They ground the plane. We don't have the option to do that. So, you know, it isn't perfectly symmetrical. We still have to take care of that 80-year-old who comes in with a lot of bad things going on and they're on a ventilator. We can't choose to not fly that day. So it isn't perfect, but there's a lot to learn from them. I am convinced that we are going to be better in 10 years. I'm disappointed about the last 15, I will be honest with you. But, you know, it's a work in progress. I'd like to see a lot more urgency to it. I think it is a crisis is way overused, but, you know, you get my point. I think there is a great deal of urgency to this. And I think now if we're looking at what we've been doing for 15 years and it's worked some, but not enough. I hope this says we got to be looking at this a lot differently. We got to be looking at our culture. We got to be looking at systems differently. We got to be doing more research into this. That's our hope, and I think it will happen.
Well, I think we need a few more hours for this conversation. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Stephen Michaud, president of the Maine Hospital Association, Lisa Letourneau, executive director of Maine Quality Counts, and Dora Ann Mills, vice president of clinical affairs and the director of the Center for Health Innovation at the University of New England. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Cindy Hahn produced today's show and answered your calls. This show will repeat at 7 tonight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Monday on the program, Keith Shortall and others will talk about great places to visit this summer in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.